Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. I am, of course, the Porkmeister, and I have with me the irrepressible, or is that a word, irrepressible? I'm not sure.
But, yeah, it's a word.
Irrepressible,
yeah.
But quite remarkable, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, who's with me now. Ms. Jones, a very big welcome to you, particularly as I can let our millions of listeners know you have this week been celebrating your birthday.
Well, yes, I have. And don't they come around more and more quickly every year? It's crazy, really. But yeah, we had a wonderful time. All my family came and stayed with me for the weekend.
Lovely.
And went out for lovely walks and made the most enormous Sunday lunch.
Great.
I hadn't cooked a Sunday lunch for a while.
Yeah.
For this and that reason,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And it was huge. And we seemed to be eating all day long.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Great. Well,
we'll get over it.
Yeah. Sunday lunch for me is what Britain's all about. And if I ever get a Sunday which is clear, I cook a roast, a joint. You know, I love it. And it all goes back to your childhood, doesn't it? You know, the one place we were always together was Sunday lunchtime. You know, my mum brought the big roast out of the oven. It's usually beef, sometimes lamb, and the roast potatoes and the Bisto gravy. Ah, Bisto. Do you remember that advert?
I do remember that,
yeah.
Yes. Although we never had Bisto. My mother was always, she had her own recipe for gravy, which I've adapted over the years.
Yeah.
And it's very much a non-Bisto household.
Sometimes my job was stirring the gravy. I mean, these days you get your gravy in, crystals or powder form, don't you? You know, which you tip out of a cardboard tub, you know what I mean?
And well, some people do.
Yeah, that's me. But in those days, it was a powder. It was a very fine powder, and it had to be perfectly stirred for about 4 or 5 minutes. And my job was standing on a stool stirring the gravy. But if I lost concentration and I didn't stir at the right speed, the gravy got lumpy, and I got shouted at for ruining the gravy. So, you know, that's where I learnt my gravy skills.
Can you imagine allowing a child to stir a hot pan of gravy these days?
No, you're absolutely right. Everything went on the stove in those days, including my mum's dolly tub, believe it or not, in which she used to boil clothes. That's how we...
What's a dolly tub?
A dolly tub is a big iron tub, and you fill it full of water from a hose pipe, and then you put it on top of the stove and turn all four burners on, because it's not a very big stove, and the water boils, and then you wash your clothes in it, you know, a pair of wooden tongs. And, you know, my mum would push the clothes in with washing powder and they would come out very, very white. One of the proudest moments for my mum was when I came home from school once and we'd had like gym that day, you know, PE, physical exercise or something. And our PE teacher was a guy called Tom Clamp, okay? Which is a funny sounding name. Hey, Tom Clamp. Everybody took the mickey out of him. But he was head of physical education. He was a former army PE instructor during the Second World War, can you believe? And, a strict disciplinarian. And he said to me one day as we came out of the gym, he said, "Young Parry," he said, "I've never seen a gym kit as sparklingly white as yours. Tell your mum she's done a great job." And I went home and told my mum, and she was thrilled, you know, absolutely thrilled.
Women took pride in their laundry and the condition of their homes,
yep.
How polished the brass doorstep and the door knocker were.
Yep.
And it was as though women were judging each other, wasn't it?
Well, it was a bit like that as well. You know, my mum would always whiten my pumps for me and that kind of stuff. And she'd shout at me if she saw me go to school one day after playing football the previous day, but I hadn't cleaned my boots properly, you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
because
the standards have slipped, haven't they, Michael?
Enormously. To her, everything that, you know, represented me was a reflection of the way she ran the house, you know what I mean? So she was a stickler for it all, obviously.
I think mothers, we still feel that, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had remarked to one of my daughters recently about something or other. I said, oh, you know, it reflects badly on me. And she laughed at me and said, why does it? Well, they don't quite understand our mindset, I think.
No, I totally agree. You know, my mum always thought, I can't have people thinking I've not brought my children up properly and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
We're judging ourselves, really, is what we're doing.
I suppose you're right. I suppose we are, yeah. Right. Birthdays for me are a non-event. I think I've told you this before, but if I haven't, I'll bore you with it now. But my birthday is on the 29th of December. So, of course, I never get a proper birthday. Christmas happens 25th and 26th. New Year happens sort of 30th, 31st, 1st. And wedged in between that is poor Michael's birthday. No presents. It was always, oh, that's for Christmas and your birthday. So I lost
out. Oh, no, I hate that.
Yeah, I know. I lost out on birthdays all my life, I'm afraid.
What, even your parents said that?
No. Mum and Dad would always get me something else, but everybody else, all the aunties and all that, oh, no, that's for Christmas and your birthday, you know. But I didn't get a double present. I didn't get a present twice as big as everybody else's Christmas present. So I felt that I was...
Hard done by.
I think we should mention to our audience, Miss Jones, that this is the first Planet Porky of the Carolean era, isn't it? Just explain, please, the Carolean era.
Well, as in the Elizabethan era. Yep. So Carolean is the Latin-derived word referring to King Charles.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. So I feel a great sense of optimism. There's been a lot of gloom and doom about, not just recently in weeks and months, but in years. So I've decided now to try and take off that overcoat of gloom and doom and look to the future very optimistically. And, you know, sometimes if you do that and if you wish hard enough to make things happen, they do happen. So that is going to be my life mantra from now on, Miss Jones.
Oh, that sounds very optimistic, Mr. Parry.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about life mantra, by the way, I like reading the business pages because the stories about business are so interesting and it affects all our lives, doesn't it? You know, with unemployment, inflation, all that. I read a story saying the return of the life mortgage, and then said some people will be taking out mortgages now for 30 years. I thought that was standard. I thought the big problem these days was people taking out 50-year mortgages. When I was growing up, my parents always said, getting back to Mum and Dad again and our little house in Laurel Grove in Chester, that by the time we were grown up, we would all be going out for dinner one Saturday night to celebrate paying off the mortgage. Because in post-war Britain, boomer Britain after the Second World War, people got married and they took out a 25-year mortgage. They used to get married in their mid-20s. So usually the mortgage was gone when they were 50 and their children were about 22 or 23 and everybody went out and celebrated. I mean, that was standard for years. But then when I started getting mortgages, they were still 25. But by the time I bought the sort of last properties I bought, you could get mortgages for 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, and people in their 80s can still get a mortgage.
You're joking.
No, they can't.
Well, how do they pay it back?
Well, they've just got to demonstrate that they have the means to repay it, which, you know, some people obviously have.
Oh. Well, I mean, they must be working then, because to repay a mortgage, you need a monthly income, don't you?
Or they have an income from family means or, you know, from an inheritance, some other thing like that.
Yeah, oh, well.
Or I suppose if they say that they can promise an inheritance that's pending.
Right, I see.
You know, somebody hasn't died yet or something.
Yeah,
like that. It's a bit grim, isn't it, really?
It is a bit grim. But, of course, the price of property now is so ridiculous compared. I mean, I've told the people this before. I bought my first house when I was in my sort of early 20s and I was working for the Express in Manchester for less than twice my income. I was earning £12,000 and the house cost £20,000. I mean, the idea now of buying a house, certainly in Greater London, or a flat even, you know, for twice your income, I mean, you know, probably £500,000 in Greater London would get you a two-bedroom, two-bathroom flat. Well, nobody else...
It wouldn't even get you that, actually.
No, probably wouldn't.
No,
probably wouldn't.
No. You're looking at £500,000 for a one-bedroom flat in Southeast London now.
Yes, you are.
And I read a piece the other day that was talking about property prices in London in 20 years' time.
Right.
And they reckon a one-bedroom flat in Mayfair will set you back £36 million in 20 years' time.
Good God, that's utterly ridiculous, isn't it?
Isn't it? So the whole of the whole of inner London will be owned by foreign countries in the end.
Well,
because
yeah.
we won't be able to afford the property.
Well, a lot of it is already owned by foreign countries. There's blocks of flats around me, even in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, owned by block Russian investors, block Chinese investors. You're absolutely right. It is quite remarkable. You know, London's a magnet for money from all over the world, and people don't put it in banks anymore because there's no interest rates. They put it in property, but you're absolutely right.
Well, that's terrifying because it ends up that the real estate of our own country belongs to somebody else.
Yeah, I think you may well be right. And, of course, we're strange in this country because we've always been brought up to, you know, I remember my dad telling my two sisters, you know, oh, make sure when you meet a chap and you marry, make sure that, you know, you've got your own home for the safety and security of your future and all that. And that's been the dictum. But that is not the same, as you probably know better than me, in America. And it's not the same in Germany. People rent and they rent freely. And my argument against rentals has always been it's money down the plug hole because the property will always appreciate in value.
Yeah, definitely. And what happens when they get to retirement age and they can't pay the rent anymore?
Yeah, well, that's another point. I've never managed to work out how that happens. Do people in this country who live in council flats, is the rent paid for? When I say council, it's called social housing now, isn't it? It always used to be called a council flat. When they get to 65 or retirement age, is their rent then paid for by the council or the government or something?
I suppose they get housing allowance on top of their state pension.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
The state pension's crept up, hasn't it? People are looking at a bit more coming in from the government nowadays than they were until recently.
I don't think it's very much. I think it's still only about 10 grand a year or something. And,
you
know, 10 grand a year is not even £1,000 a month, is it? So
it's not, but millions of people are living on that.
Yes, I know. It's a cost of living crisis situation. You're absolutely right. Tell me, Miss Jones, were you ever a fan of the popular TV series MASH?
No, it was a bit before my time. Obviously, I know what it is.
Yeah.
I know that Alan Alda starred in it.
That's right.
And I remember the theme tune.
Do you know, that's the thing I most remember about it. In the early morning mist I see. Da, 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 da. And then the punchline is, and suicide is painless. It brings on many changes. It was a beautiful record. I don't know who sung it, but
it was a lovely song. And it was, believe it or not, it was number one in the UK singles chart.
Really? I didn't know that.
In May 1980.
Good God.
And it was written by a couple, Johnny Mandel, a composer, who also wrote for Frank Sinatra and Barbara Streisand.
Golly.
And his lyricist was Michael Altman on this occasion. We haven't really heard of them for any other reason, have we?
No, not for any other reason at all. The reason I mention it is I just saw a picture of Alan Alda with another guy who was in it, whose face I recognised, celebrating 50 years of MASH. So you were talking about 1980 it was number one?
Yes.
Yeah, so it must have been sometime after it started then, or you know, it came out.
There was a film of it, wasn't there? Wasn't that in 1970? So as I say, a bit before my time.
Right. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, a long time ago. It's amazing, actually. Well, I think it was recycled quite recently.
Yeah, I think it was. But
it's one of those cult series that you either got into it at the time and then you want to revisit it, or it just completely went over your head.
That's right. Just for the benefit of millions of our listeners who won't be aware of it, MASH, I think, stands for something about a military hospital. M is military. I don't know what ANS was, but H is hospital. And it was based on the Korean War. And all the people in it were medics working in this military hospital in, you know, out in the jungle in Korea and all that. I do remember the female lead. Her name, her character, was Hot Lips Houlihan.
Oh, yes. So it was. Yeah, I do remember reading
about
that.
She was a very glamorous blonde lady. And, of course, all the young doctors were all, you know, chasing her and that kind of stuff. But there you go.
These young medics.
These young medics, absolutely. Now, listen, very sadly, I want to talk to you about an old colleague of ours. I'm not sure if he's a colleague of yours directly, but Roger Bamber, some photographer, who for many years was married to a female journalist on The Sun. I've forgotten her. Sham Lancaster, was it?
Yes. Shan actually rose through the ranks, didn't she? She was an associate editor at the Sunday Telegraph.
Oh, was she? I didn't know that.
She was on The Sun for 12 years. She was royal reporter on The Star.
Oh, was she? I didn't know that.
And she also was, she was news editor at the Daily and Sunday Express, and also worked at the Sunday Mirror. So she'd been around.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They were together for 40 years. It would have been 40 years this year.
Yeah.
But he just died very sadly. He was 78.
78, yeah. I worked with Rog because I worked at The Sun for a while, and he was a great guy, as always, very helpful to younger people, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I read in one of the obituaries that he literally walked into the pub, saw Sham Lancaster for the first time, and that was it. Smitten, and got to know her, and they got together and married very shortly afterwards. So it's quite a romance, though, isn't it?
Love at first sight. Yeah. It does happen.
Yeah.
And he moved to Brighton. That's where they live.
Oh, that's right.
Because he loved steam trains. And isn't there something called the Bluebell Railway?
Yes, there
down
is.
In the Brighton
yes.
region. He was absolutely in love with that. And also with Brighton buses.
Golly. Good for Roger. I do remember him. And he was
yeah.
a very nice guy.
The reason, I don't recall ever meeting him personally, but I did know of him because he'd worked at the Mail before I got there.
Oh, did he? Yeah.
But he did some very famous photographs of David Bowie as Ziggy Stardust
right.
in the 1970s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, I saw that. Yeah, that's all fascinating stuff, isn't it? Now, Miss Jones, being a woman about town and having been, you know, a celeb, really, a celeb journo for such a long time, you'll be very familiar, I would imagine, with the inside of Harrods, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I've been to Harrods quite a lot over the years. Mm. I tell you, when I went off it was when Mohammed Al-Fayed bought it.
Yeah.
And he took it over and it seemed to lose class. It used to be a very, very classy emporium.
That's a very snobby thing to say, isn't it?
I don't think so. No, I think a lot of people would agree with me. It became rather tacky and started peddling lots of branded goods,
yeah.
you know, with Harrods scrawled all over them,
yeah.
bags and teddy bears and all kinds of stuff.
Really?
But it does have a couple of really lovely restaurants
yeah.
in there.
Yeah.
I used to meet Andy Peebles in there, former Radio 1
oh, right.
DJ. Yeah. He lives up in Blackburn.
Yes.
Blackburn, yes. He lives there. So he would 10, come down.
10,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire.
That's the one. Yeah. There's a particular brand of coffee that he can only get in Harrods.
Right.
So he would come down periodically from Blackburn. I would meet him
yeah.
in one of the restaurants in Harrods and we'd have lunch.
Oh, that's very nice. Now, the reason I mention that is because I've read that Harrods are now into takeaways. Have you seen this? Why would you order a takeaway from Harrods? You know,
what kind of takeaway?
Well, takeaway like food, you know what I mean?
Yeah, obviously food, but surely not like a curry or
no caviar. You know, caviar on toast.
Takeaway caviar.
Yeah, yeah, and all this kind of stuff.
Well, that's mad.
Well, it is mad, isn't it? You know, and I thought, well, surely you'd just send the, you know, you'd have plenty of lackeys around. You just say, I'll go over to Harrods and get me a jar of caviar or something like that, wouldn't you?
So I suppose this means that they deliver it instead of you nip in and buy
that's
it.
That's what it's all about, you know, the old Deliveroo phenomenon, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you ever use that?
Hey, no.
Do you ever use Deliveroo? I think it's phenomenally expensive.
Right, go on.
It's just not something I really want to do because it feels like throwing money away. If you desperately need a takeaway, you can either ring up and then go and pick it up or whatever else. Go and eat it in the restaurant, you know. But it's, Deliveroo, I think, is a real ripoff.
Well, I'm not into ordering food up because I always wonder where it's really come from. Do you understand what I mean?
Well, exactly.
You know, I'm thinking to myself, oh, if I want a takeaway, there's a Chinese takeaway near to a station I use, and I can come out of the station, walk across the road, and I can sit there and watch it being made. Do you see what I mean? It takes about 10 to 15 minutes. When I say watch it being made, I'm one side of the counter, and the lady taking the money's on the other side, and behind her is a door into the kitchen, but I can hear it being made, you know what I mean? And then when I've got it, it's piping hot and it's in the silver containers or the plastic containers or whatever. And I take it home and it's been with me from start to finish. But I am very, very aware. The only thing I will deliver and have delivered at home is pizza. I love takeaway pizza because I know it's fresh pizza that's been made because you see them making them all the time when you're in the shop waiting to pick your own up. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. There was a scandal, wasn't there, I think it was Gordon Ramsay.
Oh, yeah.
And they were doing delivered food from, it was purporting to be from Gordon Ramsay restaurants. Ah. But actually they were being made on in these kind of trade parks,
yeah,
in great big sort of garages.
Yes.
And they weren't coming from the restaurant at all.
I see. Yeah. Well, that's that is a nightmare, that. You just don't know where it's coming from, do you?
And you don't know who's involved.
No. But I certainly wouldn't order stuff from Harrods. That's just ridiculous. The reason I mention it, actually, is because I've never been in Harrods. Sorry, this is the main point of me asking.
I can't believe that. You've never been
inside. I can't.
It's a bit of a tourist destination.
I can't believe I've never walked through the door of Harrods. I mean, I don't know why. You know, everything else that you should do if you've been in London for 30 or 35 years, I've done, you know, been on the London Eye and been up and down the River Thames and been to Wembley Stadium a million times. And all, but for someone, I'm going to correct that, because somebody told me there's about half a dozen bars in Harrods. Is that right?
Yeah, there are. Yeah.
Well, I'm going
to. What we should go in? Why don't we arrange to go to Harrods
I think we should. I think we should meet in town sometime.
And just go and do a little recce of all the departments, because it is a bit of an eye opener.
Yes. Yes, I should imagine. I know what you mean about Mohammed Al-Fayed. I mean, he was the greatest self-publicist in the world, wasn't he? You know, he's the man who put Michael Jackson's statue inside Fulham football ground just because he knew Michael Jackson. What relevance that had to Premier League football, nobody's ever been able to work out. But nevertheless, he did. He was and is, he's still alive, Mohammed Al-Fayed, a very interesting man. I mean, you know, immensely wealthy. Nobody quite knows where his money came from. But anyway, that's the one.
He was a fixture, wasn't he, of Private Eye for many years?
Oh, yeah, well, he was a fixture everywhere. He was, you know, I remember once a newspaper editor told me this. A newspaper editor bumped into him at lunch in the Savoy or something like that, you know what I mean? And they got chatting, and then they bumped into each other again. And Mohammed Al-Fayed said, I have decided that I know you so well now, I want to appoint you as my editor-in-chief. And this particular newspaper editor said, well, that's very kind of you, Mr. Al-Fayed. But, you know, when I last looked, I didn't see that you actually owned any newspapers. And he said, don't you fucking worry about that. You know, he was that sort of.
Oh, like, dear. Yeah. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Yeah.
So he would have actually set himself up as a newspaper proprietor.
But he did in the end, didn't he? He appointed an editor and then invented some kind of newspaper. No, I tell you what he did. He took over Punch magazine.
He did take over Punch magazine.
Yes, he did. He appointed a young editor, whose name I can't remember now, but he was a young showbiz writer, actually. I wish I could remember his name. And he's married to another showbiz writer, a lady who, you know, writes lots of sort of celebrity pieces. And I can't remember his name, but he said, yeah, you come be my editor of Punch magazine. And they turned it into like a gossip magazine, a bit like Private Eye. And it did all right for a while. Then, of course, like, you know, every publication is a startup.
Was it somebody like Marcus Berkman?
Well, somebody like that, but it wasn't Marcus Berkman. It was a young lad who I later, when it closed down, I tried to help him out by giving him some radio shows, you know, but it wasn't his forte. But anyway, good luck to him.
Oh, anyway.
Yes. Hello, everybody. I'm going to brighten up your day by telling you about Harry's, the fantastic shaving experience. Harry's are not just the super sharp razor company, people. They are much, much more. And you can start with a trial set that is absolutely free. You just have to pay for the delivery, okay? Now, in your trial pack, you get a unique engineered and weighted Harry's handle, a 5-blade cartridge complete with precision trimmer, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade carrier, or cover, I should say, if you're on the move, right? Also, a hydrating night lotion spray as an extra special gift. Now, absolutely everything you need is there for the smoothest of shaves, okay? Your trial set is packaged in beautiful aquamarine containers that let you know you're in for something special. The weighted handle makes you feel you're holding something more than just a razor. And believe me, you are. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get to those hard-to-reach places. The foaming shave gel makes the blade skim across your face like a skater on an ice rink, okay? And after a couple of splashes of night lotion, you'll feel your skin positively, I should say, invigorated and looking healthier and healthier. Now, Harry's products are put together with 0% sulfates or dyes and are alcohol-free, absolutely nothing to cause you any concern. Everything is crafted by experts who've devised invigorating formulas, and you will feel the difference no matter what your skincare goals are. So, folks, make sure to support our podcast, Life on Planet Porky, and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. So just head to harrys.com/porky and have your trial set and free night lotion delivered to your door. Let me give you that one more time. That's harrys.com/porky. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, the first one of the Carolean Age. Of course, Prince Charles, King Charles III, now reigning. And of course, I've got with me the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, what do you make of the row that comes up, you know, about three times a week about junk food, parents, ban junk foods, ban adverts? I think it's all very nanny state-ish, all this idea that people have got to be told how to feed their children.
I can't help but agree with you, because I think, yeah, you know, you can ban things, you can tax things as much as you like.
Yes.
If people are hell-bent on eating those foods, they're going to eat them.
Mm, yeah, no, I totally agree. And in my view, when a government talks about imposing a new tax for the benefit of the population, i.e., you know, the carbon tax.
For the benefit of the coffers of the Treasury.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. It's just another way of getting more money out of the public. They're trying to dress it up as it's only to help you. You know, it's a carbon tax because we've got to protect the atmosphere. Oh, it's a sugar tax because we've got to stop you feeding your children junk food. I think it's all rubbish. I hate taxes anyway.
I read this great line. It said the sugar tax was designed to incentivize manufacturers to reduce salt and sugar in foods to improve people's health.
Yeah, what a load of rubbish, eh?
Well, you know, you have to agree with that.
Yeah, the reason the salt in food is historical. It's about the Royal Navy. Because when naval ships set off, it might be 6 weeks before they hit land again. You see what I mean? So all the beef was put into barrels with salt between each layer of beef to preserve the beef. And subsequently, we learnt to eat food that had been very well salted, and we've never taken the salt out. Salt's not necessary. It's just that we don't think it tastes very nice without it.
There is enough salt in foods, occurring in foods naturally.
Yeah.
The thing about sugar is it's highly addictive.
Yes.
It's also incredibly easy to give it up. I used to take sugar.
Yeah.
In coffee. I also gave up coffee a few years ago.
Yes.
I went to rehab to give up coffee.
Oh, did you?
Because I was, yes,
rehab.
I was addicted.
Did you like
I was,
coffee?
Yeah, I did. Cost me £3,000, the best £3,000 I ever spent in my life, because I've never drunk another cup of coffee since then. But the sugar aspect, I did used to take two sugars in a cup of coffee and then decided, right, I'm going to give up sugar. This is ridiculous. Don't need it.
Yep.
I think it took about 2 weeks.
Wow.
And then I was somewhere or other and somebody put sugar in my coffee, brought it, drank a little sip, and it tasted so disgusting.
Right.
I thought, I'm cured.
Really?
And I've never had sugar in, well, I don't drink coffee now, as I said, but I never have sugar in tea.
I very rarely drink coffee. I have an odd cup here and there, but I drink tea. I used to have four sugars in my tea. And I thought, this isn't good for me. So I just cut it out. And now you're absolutely right. I couldn't stand having sugar in my tea. I love tea. I think tea tastes lovely in the morning, you know. And just a drop of milk and very hot, and it would be ruined. Now, I'm going to go back to Harrods now, because while I was talking to you, I was feverishly trying to find the details of this takeaway thing. And I found it because I'm a bit haphazard in my arrangement in my office this morning. So how about this? The Harrods takeaway menu, caviar, £125. Wagyu fillet steak, £150. Meat feast pizza, £25. sushi for four, £168. Why would anybody bother? And then bottle of Italian Barolo wine, £128. What a load of nonsense.
God. Talking about. Yeah, but if you live near Harrods, yeah. if you live in that vicinity, then you can afford this kind of thing.
Yeah, I suppose you're right, in Knightsbridge, yeah. Right, okay. Talking about expensive wine, by the way, I was at Langan's in the last couple of weeks, okay. Now, do you remember Langan's when it was like the celebrity hotspot?
Oh, yeah, I used to go there all the time.
Peter Langan was the Irish...
Peter Langan, he was often lying on the floor,
wasn't
he, when you went in?
Yeah, he was, yeah. He was permanently pissed, wasn't he? And that was part of the selling point of Langan's. Go to Langan's and get insulted by Peter Langan. Michael Caine was a partner, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Who else? There was somebody else quite well known.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, it was Michael.
Wasn't Nigel Havers or somebody like that?
Don't think so, no. But anyway, the point is that... And then it moved on from celebrity to footballers and then from footballers to city boys and all that kind of stuff. Then it closed down for a refurb and it's reopened. But you won't get me in there again. Because I went in there for lunch with one other person, right? And the bill was £400. For two.
Good God, what did you drink?
Well, this is the very point. We had lamb, whatever it is, for two. What's that called? Lamb something, shank or something.
lamb for two. Yeah, is probably what it's called.
Yeah. No, but you know, it was, you know, where they slice it on the table into lamb cutlets.
Okay.
Yeah, so maybe it was lamb cutlets.
Maybe it was lamb chops. Or
yeah, lamb chops. Yeah, I think it was lamb chops and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Lamb chops, a bit of a starter and a bit of cheese at the end, and it's £400. But that's because we had a bottle of red and a bottle of white, and the white was, what's it called now? It was a nice white anyway, and the waiter brought a bottle, put it on the table, and it was the wrong one. So he took it away and came back. The first one he brought was £150, and the second one was £125, and the red was £83. So over £200 of the £400 was wine. And I'm not
That's
going,
crazy. What's wrong with the house wine?
Well, you know, I hadn't looked at the prices of the wine, to be honest. I just didn't expect it to be that big. And the person I was with asked for a particular wine. I forgot what it was now. And I said, yeah, sure, we can have a bottle of that. And that was a very expensive wine. And I just had a red Pinot Noir or something, you know. But
I hope that your guest split the bill with you.
No, I paid because
it was
just my turn, you know what I mean? It was just one of those things. But no, the point is, I think that's a complete rip-off. I'm not going there again. Because, you know, I don't mind paying for good dining in a good, you know, nice restaurant. It is a nice restaurant. Well, now, actually, funny enough, I thought it lost a lot of its atmosphere, to be honest. We both commented that we thought it was a bit bland and a bit empty and soulless, you know, not like it used to be. It wasn't very busy, actually. And it was a Thursday lunchtime. It wasn't very busy at all. But at those prices, I can understand why not, you know. But
nowhere is as it used to be, there, is it?
Well, no, really? I suppose not. No, I suppose not. I suppose you're right. Now, Miss Jones, because I read everything all the time as much as I can, my eyes fell across one of these Dear Deirdre pages. It wasn't Dear Deirdre, it was somebody else, but, you know, Agony Aunt pages, you know what I mean? And and the title says, "Worried He Fancies My Slimmer Sister." So it's, "Dear Agony Aunt, my boyfriend has let slip. He wants me to be as skinny as my sister, and now I'm full of insecurities. I'm a curvy size 18, aged 26. My sister's 22 and a real skinny, a size 10. She looks great in everything." Now, the reason I'm reading that is not because I want your Agony Aunt view on it, Miss Jones, but years ago I went out with a girl who was very good looking, from the newspaper business, and very curvaceous. And how am I going to be kind about this? I kind of wondered whether, as she got older, whether she might put weight on, okay? Because, you know, she was a...
You thought she was going to run to fat?
Well, she was a bonny lass. And, and you know...
Oh, no.
Yeah, but anyway...
Anyway,
one time she said, oh, you know, we must go out with my sister and her husband. She had an elder sister, 5 years older, and she was married, and I said, yes, okay, that's fine. So we went out for dinner with them, but I was absolutely shocked. People are going to say this is a terrible thing for me to say, but when we arrived at the place where we were having dinner, her sister was enormous. I mean, her sister, who looked like her, was honestly an enormous girl. And, you know, without being unkind, she was fat, you know what I mean? And do you know what? It plagued me then that I thought that the girl I was going out with might end up like that in 5 years' time. And the relationship eventually broke up. But was it cruel of me to think like that?
I suppose so, because you wouldn't want to be judged by your size.
No, of course not, no.
So what's good for the goose, you know, it should work both ways. You see this quite a lot.
Yes.
And I'm not passing any personal judgment here.
Right.
But you do see this quite a lot with average-looking men who expect to have exceptionally beautiful skinny girlfriends.
Well, there's a lot more to a man than just his looks, isn't there? A woman can be defined by her looks because women are beautiful and all that, whereas a bloke can be defined by the success he's had in life or his status or is he famous or is he a successful
sportsman. Doesn't that apply to women as well?
Well, it does, but I'm sorry. Historically, in my lifetime, it's applied much more to men than to women. And people are going to say, oh, you're a sexist pig. And I say, I'm not. You know, it's always been the case that men really get a better deal in life on the looks circuit, because if they're not that good looking, it doesn't really matter. But women, I think, are always judged firsthand on how they look, aren't they?
It is true, and it is very wrong indeed.
Yeah.
And if women are successful and independent, the traditional view is that they're ball breakers.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And that's something that society's got to have a look at, I would say. Now, we're talking about weight and size and all that. Did you ever have anything to do with Matt Lucas?
Yes, I did. I did a BBC Radio 4 Great Lives programme with
fantastic.
Him about Freddie Mercury.
Fantastic.
He was a very interesting man, actually, and he was a massive fan of Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, he was also a massive fan of Arsenal, which is where I first met him, because when I used to go to Arsenal, I knew Theo Walcott's dad. Theo Walcott, very famous Arsenal player, one of England's youngest ever internationals and a superstar at Arsenal. Of course, the family had a box there. And Theo's dad was, in a line of boxes where all the families had their boxes. Matt Lucas would often come and join us. And he was a super chap. I mean, so down to earth, you know what I mean? So just normal, really. Could sit and chat with him about what was the show they did? Was it Great Britain? Was it called?
Little Britain.
Little Britain, yeah, or something like that. Yeah, Little Britain. I think you're right.
He did it with David Walliams.
That's right. Yeah, he did, and it was massively successful. I used to watch it. Although it was very funny for a couple of series. But the reason I brought up Matt's name is because he's gone on this massive diet and he's now very, very slim. When I knew him, he was quite a pudgy guy. But what's he saying here? Matt Lucas shows his resistance to bake-off cakes for a Star Wars skit. The comedian, 48, slashed his calories and started working out after being warned he was at risk of contracting diabetes. So he's gone on a massive diet and he's now starring in some show on Channel 4. What's it called? Is it called Bake Off? Is that a show?
He's one of the presenters of the Great British Bake Off.
Oh, is he? Right. Okay. Yeah. I didn't realise that. Yeah. But as I say, terribly nice chap, and gone a bit quiet recently, hasn't he? I haven't seen him doing a lot. But these guys, they come up with another brilliant idea and then go do something else, don't they?
Yeah, they do. He incidentally decided to shape up after seeing himself on television.
Oh, really?
And realizing that inside that bake-off tent,
yes,
you know, he looked ridiculously huge.
Really?
According to him.
Yeah.
Also, his father died very suddenly when he was in his early 50s.
Oh dear.
And he kind of took that to heart and thought, the way I'm eating. He got very big during the pandemic, as lots of people did.
Yeah.
And he stuffed his face with roast potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
That was his weakness. And had to take himself in hand.
Oh dear. Now, talking about football, I want to tell you about another mate of mine. His name's Paul Merson. Are you aware of Paul Merson's name?
Yes.
Yeah, he does the Saturday afternoon football, Merce. He's a former, funnily enough, he's a former Arsenal player as well, and played for England. But Merce has got some shocking problems, one of them being gambling. He's a gambling addict. Literally, he has an addiction. And I've read a terrible story about him in the last couple of days, where through he got another bout of anxiety, and he lost £160,000 in 3 days.
Betting. Oh God!
And do you know what he's betting on? It's a story he's only just told, but it happened during the pandemic and lockdown. He got anxiety about the lockdown because the Saturday afternoon football programme that he stars in with Jeff Stelling was off air because there was no football. Do you remember we had to curtail football during the pandemic? So he thought he was going to be in trouble earnings-wise and maybe even career-wise. It would never come back. So he got a terrible panic attack and he went out and he blew £160,000, which he and his third wife had put together as a deposit for a house. And he just blew it just like that. And people will say, that's dreadful, that's disgusting, you know, she should have left him, all that. But I know Merce very well because I helped him out the first time he had the problem. The first time he had the problem, he not only had a gambling addiction, but that drove him to drink. He was an alcoholic. And he also ingested large amounts of cocaine because he was such a mess. And he fled abroad. He literally fled abroad and, you know, was begging for help. And the Football Association, where I was working at the time, brought him back and we rehabilitated him. So I was alongside Merce for, you know, quite a few months, actually, trying to help him out. And I helped him write a book explaining all his addictions and his... and I feel so sorry for him because he is genuinely a very nice lad who can't resist this terrible addiction he's got to gambling. The way he used to explain it was, look, gambling's my addiction, but I used to drink a lot to try and block it out, you know, the thought of going gambling. And because I liked the effect that drink gave me, I started taking cocaine so I could stay up 24 and 48 hours and keep drinking. I mean, just imagine having to face that sort of nightmare in your life.
He sounds like he needs some fairly long-term heavyweight therapy.
Oh, he's had loads.
An establishment such as the Priory.
He's had loads. He's tried everything. I'm not sure if he's tried the Priory, but Tony Adams was another addict in football. Tony Adams, again, an Arsenal player, captain of Arsenal, captain of England. He became a chronic alcoholic. And he eventually did seek help and got help. And he founded a clinic. What's it called, this clinic? Let me see. Sporting Chance, that's right. Sporting Chance was the clinic. And Mercer's been there, you know, quite a few times and all that. But, my God, I know. Mercer's lost altogether, we worked it out, about £7 million in gambling.
Oh, good God, yeah. That's horrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And
that is horrifying.
And you think of what footballers earn these days. And, you know, he said in this latest piece I read that young footballers could be gambling away £150,000, £200,000 a week because they earn £300,000 a week. You know what I mean?
And people say that they're not paid too much.
Yeah, yeah, well, exactly, yeah.
If they didn't have those kinds of wages, they wouldn't have this kind of money to burn.
Well, you say that, but then again, when they were earning £60 a week, there were plenty of footballers in those days who were gambling away £60 a week. Honestly, I knew a couple at Everton, my club, you know, and, you know, the stories filtered out from the club that, oh, you know, he's in the bookies. I mean, one footballer, Stan somebody, I've forgotten his name.
Stan Bowles.
Stan Bowles, well done. Thank you very much.
I did an extensive feature with him.
Did you?
Spent a lot of time with
him.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
Go on, yeah.
Yeah, so they used to say of Stanley Bowles that if he could pass a betting shop the way he could pass a ball,
right,
he'd be a very rich man indeed.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And do you know what? This might be an apocryphal tale, but I don't think it is because so many people have told me when I've been to QPR, you know, go to QPR, go in a box there, talk to long-standing fans there, long-time fans, that you could actually meet Stan Bowles at 2:30 in the betting shop across the road from across the street from Loftus Road where QPR paid. And he was still putting bets on horses at 2:30 before dashing across the road in through the player's entrance, get changed and out onto the pitch.
Yeah, his big weakness as well was the dogs.
The dogs, that's right. Yeah, 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 I think you're right, yeah.
I think he owned a couple of greyhounds as well. He was a tremendously nice man. We spent quite a lot of time together,
yes,
working on this feature.
Yes.
He did publish a book eventually. A respectful man, very smart, very well turned out.
Yeah.
And he said that he grew up in poverty.
Yes.
And his father had told him, it's not a crime to be poor.
Right.
but it is a crime to look poor. Mm. So he always had handmade suits and so on. Golly. He always looked beautifully turned out.
Golly, that's amazing. The way people try to pull themselves up in life. Now, Ms. Jones, I'm going to give you a bit of medical advice now. The way to stay fit and healthy forever is big breakfast, small dinner. Is that you?
Well, we've known that for donkeys.
Well, I've just read it from Michael Mosley, who is,
what is he like? I mean, he's just repeddling something that we've known, well, I've known since I was a child. My grandfather used to say, breakfast like a king, dine like a pauper.
Really? But do you follow that?
Sometimes.
Well, I get hungry when I come in at night. I can't eat a small meal. I want a big meal.
I don't like to eat a heavy meal late into the evening because that keeps me awake.
Yes, I know. I agree with that. I always make sure I've eaten by the time the 6 o'clock news comes on the BBC, okay? I'm not one of these who can sit there and watch the news and eat at the same time. I like to focus on what I'm watching. And you're absolutely right. Sometimes, you know, maybe I've not come until 8:30 or 9 o'clock and I've picked a takeaway up from my favourite Chinese takeaway that I was telling you about. And I'm eating at 9, 9:30. And then I've had a long day and I think by 10:30, I think I'll turn in. But you're absolutely right. You have a restless night's sleep if you've got a chow mein, whatever, in your tummy.
Oh, that makes me feel sick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But, you know, the other thing about the big breakfast, not everybody can stomach, can face a big cooked breakfast first thing in the morning. It can make you feel quite ill.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I don't have any problem with breakfast because every day of my life now, I either have a sausage sandwich or a bacon sandwich. So I don't need to even think about it. All I do is stock up the fridge with sausages and bacon, and I make sure I've got a supply of fresh bread or bread rolls or croissants. And it's not a problem for me. I don't have to think at all. Oh, what shall I have for breakfast today? Because it's routine.
All right. Okay. So you would cook a bit of bacon or a sausage. No. I think it's every day. It's the thought of doing it every day. I quite like scrambled eggs. Mm-hmm. I might have them on a bit of toast or on a bagel or just by themselves or an omelette or something.
Yes.
But I don't want to eat that every single day.
Well, I don't want to risk not enjoying my breakfast. I know that sounds ridiculous, and I know how much I enjoy a sausage sandwich or a bacon sandwich, so I just stick with it.
Yeah, I get it, yeah. I sometimes have porridge. I do make porridge, and I don't put sugar or honey or anything.
Right.
I put frozen blueberries
into the porridge. Oh, yeah, that sounds nice, yeah.
Because by the time they've heated up, you know, the blueberries melted and so on. Mm. That I sometimes have, or bit of bran flakes or a banana.
Right. Yeah.
I rarely run out the door with nothing at all, even if it's just a cup of tea.
Yeah. I never eat lunch, you see, because my modus operandi is to get breakfast out of the way. Supposing I was doing a morning TV show or something like that, I'd probably be eating at sort of 4:30 or 5 a.m., right?
Oh, I was going to ask you that. Yeah. So if you're doing a television,
yes.
Would you make a bacon sandwich at 2 in the morning?
Yes, I would, yes, yes.
Would you really?
Yes, because I don't like going around on an empty stomach for one reason. Is your tummy rumbles, you know, if you haven't put anything in it. It's the gastric juices in your stomach and all that. So I always have something to eat before I go out. It makes me feel better and I feel more confident. But then if I finish at 11 or 12 o'clock, I might go and have a quick drink on the way home. But I wouldn't then eat at lunchtime. I would then wait till sort of 5 o'clock, you know what I mean? So I only ever have two meals a day.
Yeah, well, that's standard. Yeah. I think that's – nobody needs, I don't think, three meals
neither,
a day.
Neither do
anyway.
I. There was – when I worked in New York, there was a guy there who worked for the Mirror, David somebody. David Bradbury, I think his name was. If you're listening, David, welcome. Great days in New York in the 80s and 90s and all that. But David insisted – on three meals a day. He would go out for breakfast, and then at about 2 o'clock, he would go out for quite a long lunch, and in the evenings at 8 o'clock, he'd go to a restaurant and have a substantial dinner. and by the way, he wasn't the size of a mountain or anything. He was just a culinary freak, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. Some people seem to be able to pack it away, don't they?
Right, without it.
And never put anything on, but Yeah, other people only have to look at a cake and it's sitting on their thighs.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
In fact, I used to think there was a thing about cutting out the middleman, wasn't there, and not bothering to eat the cake, but just spreading it on your legs.
Oh, dear me, Miss Jones. not an irritant.
And on that note.
Yeah, on that note, absolutely. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another week here on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for having joined us. And we'll be back with you again, same time next week. I think we should mention to our audience, Miss Jones, that this is the first Planet Porky of the Carolean era, isn't it? Just explain, please,
yes.
The Carolean era.
Well, as in the Elizabethan era. Yep. So Carolean is the Latin-derived word referring to King Charles.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. So I feel a great sense of optimism. There's been a lot of gloom and doom about, not just recently in weeks and months, but in years. So I've decided now to try and take off that overcoat of gloom and doom and look to the future very optimistically. And, you know, sometimes if you do that and if you wish hard enough to make things happen, they do happen. So that is going to be my life mantra from now on, Miss Jones.
Oh, that sounds very optimistic, Mr. Parry.
Yeah, absolutely. Every day of my life now, I either have a sausage sandwich or a bacon sandwich. So I don't need to even think about it. All I do is stock up the fridge with sausages and bacon, and I make sure I've got a supply of fresh bread or bread rolls or croissants. And it's not a problem for me. I don't have to think at all. Oh, what shall I have for breakfast today? Because it's routine.
There was a thing about cutting out the middleman, wasn't there? And not bothering to eat the cake, but just spreading it on your legs.
Oh, dear me, Miss Jones. not an irritant.
And on that note.
Yeah, on that note, absolutely.